cited now, of course, you know. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Paul. Counsel is very well briefed and very well argued. We'll be issuing an opinion within the 90-day statutory timeframe. Thank you. Good afternoon, Council. Yes, it is afternoon already. Thank you for hanging there with us. Today is Tuesday, February 19th, 2019. This is our fifth and final oral argument case for the day. It is A18-1501, DuPong versus Mayo Clinic Health System, Red Wing Appellant. Council, for Appellant, you'll have 15 minutes. Followed by 15 minutes by respondent and 5 minutes for rebuttal. I think both of you know the drill, so you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. Kate McBride here for Mayo Clinic Health Systems Red Wing. There is only one issue before this court, and that is, did the district court commit prejudicial error by excluding impeaching evidence statement that plaintiff's attorney made in a February 27, 2014 letter to Mayo's in-house counsel? The answer to that is unquestionably yes, because first, the error was absolutely admissible under 801D2, because it was an authorized statement made within the scope of agency, and two, a statement adopted by the party. And the second part is that it was prejudicial, because it might reasonably have changed the results had it been admitted. The only analysis we have from the district court is in volume one of the transcript on page 57, where the court says, the statement made in that letter to the court is a factual statement. In this instance, plaintiff's attorney is reciting facts, and the plaintiff's attorney was clearly not in the room at the time. I'm not going to have the fact finder get into it. While it is true that admission and exclusion of evidence is within the court's discretion, this court, the district court, made a factual determination that the attorney got it wrong. But it is the jury and not the court that is to decide credibility and weigh the facts. This court invaded the province of the jury, and it is not within the court's discretion to do that.
Could I ask you this? Because, I just want to break it down a little bit, because one of the arguments is that when the attorney wrote this letter, since the attorney was acting as the principal, or the agent, I should say, of the plaintiff here, that in that case, whatever factual statements he put in that letter are admissions of his client. Now, are you arguing here today that any time an attorney sends a letter to an opposing counsel with the facts, with his or her understanding of the facts, that all of those statements become admissions?
In this circumstance, when the attorney is speaking about facts that the plaintiff herself has personal knowledge of, most unquestionably, yes. Might there be some circumstance out there that I can't contemplate now? But certainly under these circumstances, and this court has already said that is indeed the case. In Coob versus Salad, this court, which was a post-rule of evidence case, said that an attorney's statement is admissible. There were two accidents. And a 2003 accident and a 2004 accident. And the plaintiff's attorney sent a demand letter to defense counsel for the 2003 accident and said, hey, a significant portion of the plaintiff's medical expenses were attributable to this 2003 accident, so pay up. This court said that was a statement made within the scope of agency, therefore it was a statement of a party opponent and not hearsay and admissible. The cases that plaintiffs rely on are, one, pre-rule of evidence cases, and they focus, this is, I think, very significant. Those cases all focus on whether the attorney had, quote, special authority. But, quote, special authority is not required by the rule. And in fact, I'd like to point out to the court the committee comment that says this, quote, rather than focusing on the agent's authority to speak for the principal, the rule requires only that the statement be made concerning a matter within the scope of agency. So yes, when an attorney makes a statement within the scope of the agency, like here, that statement is admissible as this court has already held. And the court erred by not following the rule of evidence. And under this rule, the statement was admissible. This is not about binding a plaintiff to any statement that the attorney made. And that is what the plaintiff discusses and says over and over throughout the brief, bind, 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 we cannot bind the client. But we're seeking here to impeach, not bind, and it's not conclusive against the plaintiff. She could get up there and explain and contradict it, and it's up to the jury, not a court, to decide whether she's telling the truth. The plaintiff's cases are an opposite because they deal with a settlement agreement and a statute. And again, I want to turn the court's attention to the very comments in the rule itself. The 2006 amendment comments significantly say, you know what, we changed the title of this rule from admission of a party opponent to statement of a party opponent. And the comment goes on to say, the amended title clarifies that the statement by a party opponent need not be an admission of guilt or liability in order to be excluded from the definition of hearsay.
Counsel, I'm sorry, finish that thought.
No, I'm done with that.
As you mentioned, the trial judge didn't go into very much detail as to the basis of the ruling for excluding this letter or reference to the letter. But it seemed the judge was concerned that it would require getting into attorney-client communications, or potentially concerned about that, getting into, you know, how the lawyer learned about this version of the facts. And is that something that should be of concern?
Absolutely not, Your Honor, and here's why. Because the attorney made that statement, and once the attorney made the statement about, this is what my client said. My client said Dr. Ball examined her, pushed on her abdomen, and Michelle said it hurt. That statement is already out there. There is no privilege attached to that statement. There needs to be no further discussion about that because the attorney already revealed that statement to opposing counsel. Moreover, and secondly, and importantly, is the second ground for admission, and is that this statement was adopted by Ms. Dupont herself. First of all, she received a copy of that letter way back when it was sent, but then she adopted the statement in her answers to interrogatories, referring to them three times. Now, these are answers signed and sworn under oath. She swears to their truthfulness. The plaintiff obviously had personal knowledge of this information. No one else could say, and it hurt. It hurt me when he did that. Interrogatory number 15 says, please specify each act or omission that was a violation of the standard of care. And the answer was, see my complaint and see the 227-14 letter. The Kelly case has no impact on the admissibility of these answers to interrogatories and the adoption by the plaintiff. The Kelly decision has to be looked at in two parts. The first part really isn't applicable here because the court was looking at pleadings, and pleadings are complaints, answers, replies, etc. And they said, because we have notice pleading, because we want pleadings, complaints are to just give fair notice, and because we allow inconsistent pleadings, we're not going to hold plaintiffs to statements in pleadings, but answers.
Can I stop you there for a second before you go on to the second one? Because I think it's related to this. So if she hadn't, following your argument, if she hadn't adopted the statements in the interrogatories, would the letter itself have been something that would, you'd still be arguing that should have been allowed?
Correct, Your Honor, yes, and that's a good point.
Why?
There
Why?
Are two independent grounds, because there are four, five, subdivisions under 801D2. This case falls within two or three of them, really, but the scope of agency, within the scope of agency and a party adopted. So we've got it both ways. They've got it covered. As I said, there's no question this is an admissible statement under 801D2. The second part.
That's her adoption of the statement, of the letter, as her statement become then an admission rather than just a statement, I guess.
There was no attempt, there was no argument, and no, the rule itself, as the comment I just read to you said, these are impeaching statements, they're not admissions. The court couldn't direct verdict because she said this in her interrogatory. Absolutely not. But they are admissible, and they are admissible impeaching statements. And Kelly says, when a person has personal knowledge of a statement, which clearly, again, she does, I don't want to repeat myself, the interrogatory is admissible. And then, even then, as the trial went on, we found that the plaintiff opened the door to this testimony by her questioning, her counsel's questioning of Dr. Mayorchek. It should have been certainly allowed then, regardless of the earlier ruling. Whether plaintiff's counsel intended to do that or not is of no import. Intentions of counsel are simply not relevant under opening the door. Dr. Mayorchek was repeatedly challenged for the basis for his opinion that Dr. Ball did not violate the standard of care because he did perform an abdominal exam. But he would have said, in addition to this, I am relying on the statement in that letter. The last thing that a party coming forward asking for a new trial has to establish is prejudicial error. And the standard of review here is that an error in exclusion of evidence is prejudicial and grounds for a new trial if it might reasonably have changed the results had it been admitted. And I think there's no question that we fall within that standard of review. Whether Dr. Ball performed an abdominal exam was central to the issue. I read the transcript. I'm sure you have too. It's obvious that what he did, the last doctor to see her, was critical. Who was the jury to believe, Michelle or Dr. Ball? Because he was the last one to see her before the appendix burst, what he did or didn't do was critical to the defendant's liability. It was critical to the idea of causal negligence. Dr. Ramirez, plaintiff's expert, testified that had an exam been done, and that exam determined that Ms. Dupont did not have an acute abdomen, meaning rebound tenderness or guarding, then the standard of care would have been met. Dr. Giorgi, who saw her 7 hours before Dr. Ball, did perform an exam, and that wasn't in question, and he did not find an acute abdomen. So under Dr. Ramirez's conclusions, testimony, Dr. Giorgi would have met the standard of care. Dr. Ball testified, I'm 100% certain I did this because she came in with abdominal pain. This is how I was trained. This is what I do day in and day out. If somebody had abdominal pain, I would examine their abdomen. The letter certainly would have supported that testimony.
And well, your purpose was to use this information as impeachment. Is that correct?
Yes, because the plaintiff's credibility certainly was at issue here. We had a he said, she said kind of thing here. And her credibility was called into question, her recall of the ER and clinic details, who was with her, what happened. She was challenged on that. So the letter then would have gone further to challenge her memory of what happened and what was taking place at these ER and clinic visits. And further, it would have bolstered Dr. Mayorchek's testimony, who said he was relying on the letter when he said that he believed the exam was done. In closing, the defense counsel said on page 909 and 910, the defense is based on the assumption that an exam was done. But, quote, there's absolutely no evidence to support that except the conjecture by Dr. Ball. So that was what they were focusing on in the closing. That's what the plaintiff was focusing on. That certainly was the focus of the trial, and this evidence would have gone, but it was an incredibly important piece of evidence on the part of the defendant. So we asked the court to reverse the trial court and grant a new trial on liability. Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Will Flegel, and I represent the respondent, Ms. DuPong, in this matter, who asked this court to affirm the decision below. The fact that a trial court can do something does not mean that a trial court must do something. The fact that evidence can be admitted does not mean that evidence must be admitted. Those are issues reserved the exercise of the trial court's discretion. We would ask you to affirm the exercise of that discretion in this case for two reasons, fundamentally, that cut through all of the arguments that we've exchanged with one another.
You are denying that it would have been very helpful.
Would have embarrassed the heck out of plaintiff's trial counsel if she'd have been humiliated. And it always helps to do that to your opponent if you can. Strategically, it was a sound thing for Mr. Hagen to do.
Counsel, though, isn't whether Dr. Ball palpitated Ms. DuPong's abdomen a central issue in the case?
It was one of the issues, but one of the points I was going to make to you is that this verdict is sustainable if we completely ignore this issue. Because the way the special verdict form was written, it was, did employees of Mayo violate the standard of care? And there were two focuses at the trial. Dr. Ball was one. Dr. Georgie was the other. The theory against Dr. Georgie was that he should have ordered a CT scan based on the then prevailing symptoms. To the extent that the jury answered the question, yes, an employee of the institution violated the standard of care, and the record supports a claim against Dr. Georgie, these issues that are raised in the appeal become irrelevant because
You're saying there's no prejudice.
Yeah, that's the succinct way of putting it.
It's not reasonable that the jury would have reached it.
Right. Under the standard of review that's applicable to these post-trial motions, if the outcome is supportable on any reasonable construction of the facts, this court's responsibility as an error-correcting court is to affirm. So to the extent that the verdict is supportable by the findings regarding Dr. Georgie, that ends the matter. Can I briefly review with you the evidence with Dr. Georgie? In this case, it was Dr. Stewart, the plaintiff's expert, who provided the following testimony. This is at transcript pages 348 to 353. Number one, the standard of care required Dr. Georgie to order a CT scan, and he did not. Number two, Dr. Georgie's diagnosis that it was vomiting and volume depletion did not address the source of abdominal pain, and that departed from the standard of care. At trial, Dr. Georgie admitted he thought Ms. DuPong only had gastroenteritis. Dr. Stewart testified that was not a reasonable diagnosis and explained why. Fourth, Dr. Stewart testified that Ms. DuPong had appendicitis on November 28th when Dr. Georgie saw her, and he explained why. And finally, Dr. Stewart testified that Dr. Georgie's failure to diagnose appendicitis was a violation of the standard of care. That violation resulted in the appendix rupturing and causing harm. That would support the verdict as returned by the jury, and these issues relative to Dr. Ball, Judge Cochran, become merely interesting and the subject of more of an academic debate. The two fundamental reasons.
What specific questions were put to the jury?
I don't have the special verdict in front of me, but I believe that the agreed upon question did the Mayo Red Wing deviate from the standard of care on the dates.
So was there any question put to the jury that distinguished Dr. Georgie from Dr. Burr?
None, Your Honor. That was the subject of discussion among counsel and the court. If you look at transcript page 738, lines 12 through 17, the court reflects on the record and off-the-record discussion in which, quote, a redundancy on question one, close quote, was removed. And neither side then objected to the form of the special verdict question.
Well, let me ask you this, because if you have no differentiation between the two doctors, how do we know that the jury just didn't find Dr. Brill was the...
I'm sorry?
What, how do we know which doctor?
We don't.
So, and to the extent that... So aren't you asking us to basically speculate that they found one
no,
or the,
I'm asking, I'm sorry.
Hey, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I'm asking you to accept the jury's conclusion that one of the employees violated the standard of care and that it caused harm. To the extent that either of them did under the standard of review, that's dispositive of our issues.
Well, except we don't know which one they found. I mean, is it possible they could have found both, or they could have found one?
They could have found both, and that's why I'm...
How do we know they just didn't find it was the last doctor that saw her before
sure.
her appendix burst?
Yeah. And that's why I'm here to address the other issues for you and why the thrust of our arguments back and forth focused on Dr. Ball. But what I wanted to begin with was an overriding observation that to the extent that the verdict can be substantiated on this other theory, these other issues become less consequential to this court's task. So let's turn to the issue issues raised by my colleague. First of all, Ms. McBride observed that it was for the jury and not the court to resolve issues of fact-finding. We can call it fact-finding, but trial court judges are uniformly required to exercise discretion regarding the probative value against the prejudicial value of evidence. And Ms. McBride read the entirety of the record in terms of the court's articulation of reasons why what was done was
but
done.
There wasn't a weighing of prejudice versus probative value. It was just, it's a factual issue, so I'm not going to let it in.
And I think why he felt it should not come in is important. If we can, I'll take you back to that reference at page 57, lines 19 through 23. He's talking about the fact this is secondhand information. The plaintiff's attorney was clearly not in the doctor's examining room at the time. At the time of the patient visit at issue, and it would be...
But stop right there. Why is that relevant at all? Because this is a statement by the party opponent to...
By the party opponent's attorney, yes.
To the attorney, and the attorney is relaying that. So it's not... Well, the fact that the attorney wasn't in the room when she was examined, I mean, otherwise you'd never let in any information... It just seems like such a broad exclusion that you would never allow anything.
If our sole focus is the hearsay rule, I agree with you completely. But the issue is slightly broader than that, because now we're looking at policy issues that underlie whether or not a statement made by a lawyer 2.5 years before litigation was begun can be used to impeach their client relative to what occurred at that time.
Well, and you mentioned in your brief also the fact that it occurred years before, but at the same time, I think, doesn't that cut against you because it was made closer in time to when the actual event occurred? So presumably her recollection at that time is probably going to be more accurate than years later.
Whose recollection, Your Honor?
The
lawyer's?
No, Ms. Dupong's, when she's providing that information to the lawyer to put in the letter.
Pardon me, but I think you're making an assumption there, and one that the trial judge was unwilling to entertain because it involved issues. Judge Hooten expressed concern about relative to invasion of attorney-client privilege.
Well, I don't see how it's invading the attorney-client privilege because this is being communicated out to a third party, i.e., sent out in a letter. So there's no privilege attached to that communication
okay.
at all. Or that subject matter, for that matter.
In the event that the attorney and the client having a personal exchange was the source of the information, I agree. But we don't know that on this record. We don't know if the information was read from a chart note that the care at issues in 2014, the letters in 2014. We don't know whether the source of information is from a medical record or from a personal visit
or
what. We
don't know that, but what we do know is that is her lawyer representing her and providing information on her behalf.
To a claims adjuster, yes.
Exactly. So it seems to me that this falls squarely within a principal and agent relationship. And so why isn't it admissible purely on that basis right there?
In the event that it were reduced to a simple question of does 801 D2 apply and we're dealing with a party admission, then under the modern
statement.
I'm sorry. It will always be a party admission, just like it will always be Dayton's. I'm sorry. And I'm going to try to speak correctly, but I'm going to inadvertently revert to the former usage.
Completely understand.
Okay. With respect to the issue of a party statement, under the modern iteration of that, we simply look at why this, or whether an agency existed or not. What I think informs this court's judgment, when we look at what the broad impact would be of any communication by a lawyer regarding facts now becoming something that can be admitted to impeach someone who we don't know had any direct input into that formulation, we should look at what the trial judge did.
Right, but isn't that the fact that it's not? And I think that change is a valid change from admission to a statement, because nobody's claiming that this is an admission that's going to bind her. All that is being disputed, is stated, is that this is apparently a statement that she made, and why can't that be introduced to be able to impeach her? And she can certainly refute it and say, you know what, one, I never told my attorney that. Two, I don't know what he was doing and what he was thinking. Three, he didn't understand what I said. Or four, I never made that statement.
Or he made an assumption.
Actually, it's
a she, so I'm sorry.
Right. So I mean, there's. It's just to bring it in order to be able to have that aired out in court as to that particular fact issue. But let's put that aside for a second. Let's assume that's not enough.
Okay.
What about the fact that she uses that in her interrogatories?
That's where I'd like to go next, if we could.
I'd love to have you go there,
okay,
too.
Okay, perfect. There are three references in the answers to interrogatories, and our brief tried to make a point of going over what was said precisely about these. So without trying to be repetitious here, I'll just have you make a note that the three questions that bear on this are interrogatory 8, 15, and 22.
Right.
And 8 asks, what injuries did you have? And the letter is referenced there. We spelled out our injuries in greater detail in this letter. It doesn't talk about abdomens, et cetera. 15 asks, what is the factual basis of the failure to diagnose claim? And what she describes is the symptoms she had then that should have been a red flag for appendicitis. And it references that what the symptoms were described in this letter.
Right, and that one seems to go directly to that issue.
Because, and I just want to follow up. It says, see the complaint as well as the February 27, 2014 letter sent by plaintiff's counsel to Joshua Murphy at Mayo Clinic.
Right.
I mean.
And one of those things that's mentioned in the first full paragraph on the second page of the letter is the abdomen in the context of describing many other details. But whether that's specifically adopted or not is unclear. In other words, the level of exposition there is not I, the plaintiff, now of my own personal knowledge in a pleading am making the statement that my abdomen was not pressed upon. It simply says, see this prior communication regarding...
Well, it's incorporated in the entire letter by reference.
Regarding a multitude of...
Putting that statement.
Regarding a multitude of other issues.
But incorporating that particular statement.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
It's incorporating a multitude of issues, but it
could embrace that statement as well.
Yeah.
As my time's waning, I'll simply point out that the third interrogatory asks for all written communications, and so the letter is referenced there. So if this applies at all through adoption, I think it would be only with regard to 15. But the thing is that Ms. DuPong herself never said that there was any, her testimony was uniformly and consistently that he had not touched her abdomen. The complaint
all the more reason why I would think you'd want to have that.
The complaint is silent. The deposition said that it occurred as she testified at trial. So in conclusion, the point is this. There is no prejudice in this case because the verdict can be sustained on other grounds. But if we look at the issues underpinning the admissibility of information to impeach, the policy reasons underlying them do not justify it here. Did you have further questions? Okay. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Just briefly, I'm going to touch on two main points. First of all, as I said, courts do have discretion to admit and exclude evidence, that they have to apply the rules of evidence. This court did not. This court said the attorney got it wrong, and we're just not going to let the fact finder decide that. I'm going to decide that. Secondly, with regard to the verdict form, Dr. Giorgi saw... Let me back up. The verdict form, it has to be viewed in the context of the standard of review here. And the standard of review is, might reasonably have changed the result. And so when we look at that, when we look at the verdict form, we know that it might reasonably have changed the result because of the focus at trial and what plaintiff's own expert said, Dr. Ramirez, said Dr. Giorgi, who performed the exam and did not find an acute abdomen, was within the standard of care. It was Dr. Ball who saw her last. It was Dr. Ball who could have caught this before, her appendix burst, if in fact that was their claim, that she was there with an acute abdomen at that time. So it was critical to the finding of causal negligence, and again, might reasonably change the result.
Can you address the argument that's made that there are actually several reasons why Dr. Giorgi might, as long as he's liable, it doesn't really matter what happens with Dr. Ball?
Sure, because, without repeating myself, I'm not sure I can, but after Dr. Giorgi saw her before Dr. Ball, right. And we know that plaintiff's expert said, if a doctor examines your abdomen and does the pushing and the touching and goes all around and looks for rebound tenderness and guarding and doesn't find that, then there is no breach of the standard of care. So their own experts came in and said that. So that's answer number one, a multi-part answer. We have their own experts saying that Dr. Giorgi, and there was no dispute that he did perform an exam, did not violate the standard of care. But most importantly, again, I will go back to what is the standard of review here? Might reasonably have changed the results. And so that, to me, is the most significant thing. We have to look at this and think, what was the focus of this trial? The focus was Dr. Ball, who could have caught this before she had a burst appendix and all the sequelae that came from that, was there to catch this last. He was there. And so the jury most certainly could have been focusing on Dr. Ball. We don't have to pull the jury in here and inquire of them. We just have to apply the standard of review. The rule does not exclude attorney statements. In fact, it embraces them because it says statements made within the scope of agency. And that's what we're going to look at. That's what the committee comment said. We're not looking at special authority. We're looking at statements within the scope of agency. And for these reasons, because the court committed prejudicial error, we ask you to reverse and allow the case to be retried on liability. Thank you.
Thank you both, counsel. Very well argued, very well briefed, as usual. We will be issuing an order within the 90-day statutory time frame. That is the last case that we have for oral arguments. The court is now in recess for the final case. Thank you all.
First time I've ever heard you hear five cases on such diverse matters. It was very impressive.
It has been a long day.
Keeps the job interesting.
It does. It does.
It's not over yet.
And you guys did a great job.
Yeah. Thank you.
As usual.
Have a good day.
Take care.